Hello, pals of mine. I'm Julie Parker, and this is Conversation Accessories. I love the Redwoods. Love them. My parents each grew up in a small town on California's North Coast, so we made several trips throughout the year from Sacramento to visit both sets of grandparents. The last segment of the drive included a tunnel of redwood trees. Even as a child, I was aware of their majestic presence. As an adult, I walk amongst them to heal my soul, truly. And it's so sad to see logging trucks rolling down the roadways with cut redwood trunks. 100 years ago, acres and acres of redwood forests were clear-cut when many, erroneously, believed that our natural resources were inexhaustible. And, of course, the timber barons just didn't care. Sometimes, though, trees do need to be cut down for the health of the forest. But what is the best way, the healthiest way for the forest? Select cut, group cut? Timber industry professional Jerry Baranek is an old logger, having worked 50 years in the woods. But he also has a love and respect for the redwoods. In fact, he's published several books on the subject.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up on the coast. I was born in San Francisco. I lived in the Bay Area for a while until I was about 7 or 8 years old. And then we moved up to Eureka and Crescent City. And my stepfather worked in the mills up there. And then we moved back down to Santa Rosa in 1961. I lived there until 66 and joined service. When I got out in 1969, I moved here.
So you stuck with the coast?
Yeah.
It's home.
Can't leave it.
No. You know, like I said, my parents were born and raised here, and I wasn't born here, but I'm returning on their behalf.
I know some people that are leaving Fort Bragg. They just say there's nothing here anymore, you know. I can't believe that they're going to go find something better. You know, I mean, it's, I don't know, you know. To me, this is, the coast is just the most beautiful place there is. You've got the ocean, the beaches, everything that goes with it. And you got the forest and the rivers. And geez, there's so much to do here.
So what do they say is missing?
Well, I was about it. My friend Jim Rosati, he's thinking about, he was born and raised here. And he's retired, and he says, I got to get out of here, Jerry. There's nothing here anymore. You know, well, his daughter died, and his wife died, and he's home alone. And maybe, you know, it's just hard for him to be here and stuff. But I can't understand when he says there's nothing here anymore. I mean, he's probably referring to his family.
Yeah.
But I've heard other people say the same thing. You know, there's nothing here. I'm going someplace where there's something better. You know, and I don't, to me, you can't, it doesn't get any better than this.
I think it's a great home base.
It is.
You can go traveling and then you come back here to heal and recover. And then you can go off to whatever it is and you come back here again. And reinvigorate your soul, as it were. And the beach, like you said, Mendocino was always considered the pretty sister back in the day because of the artist colony. But Fort Bragg. The sad thing is that Fort Bragg was always known as the mill town, which it was. But conversely, it has 10 miles of pristine beach. There's no structures. You can walk for miles and miles up and back, 20 miles, and you're away from the road. And it's just peaceful. It's quiet. And all you hear are the birds and the surf.
Oh, yeah.
So in reality, Fort Bragg was actually the prettier sister. It just didn't get the good marketing campaign.
Well, there's so many nooks and crannies along the coast. You know, the beaches aren't real vast. They're small beaches. It's 10 Mile Beach. I don't know why they call it 10 Mile Beach, because it's actually only about 6 miles long. But in between the beaches, though most of them are small, they're beautiful. And you got all these little coves, nooks and crannies, you know, that a lot of people don't get to. You have to get down to them by a rope or something, you know, or you're going to kill yourself trying. If you don't have something to help you down and get back. And that's what I always liked about the coast. There was just so much to explore as a child. And there still is. You know, there's still places here that I haven't seen. Mostly because they're on private property now. And getting access isn't getting any easier.
But to drive here to get to the coast is beautiful. Because tunnel of trees.
Some people hate the
Marl. I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, they said it's dark and dreary and through there. And I go, boy, you're missing the point here, you know. I've heard a lot of truck drivers and people that come to the coast when the mill was working. They'd come here to pick up a load, go heading back wherever they came from. And I heard a number of truckers over the years ask if there was an easier way out of here than Highway 20. And that's as good as it gets. I said, well, you could try the Leggett Road, but it's worse. You know, 128, that's a beautiful drive. But they're all windy. You know, just take your time. You can't get in a hurry, you know. Otherwise, you're missing it. You know, the scenery and everything, if you're in too much of a hurry.
So what was it like transitioning from the service back to the coast? Did you come back with a different perspective? Or
yeah, culture? I certainly did, because I joined it when I was 17 years old, and all I had lived on on the coast all my life up till then. As when we lived up in Eureka and Crescent City, driving through the Redwoods and the Avenue of the Giants all the time, I remember my mother saying, oh, why don't you kids go play in the woods or something? You know, or look at the big trees. Let's, you know, go here, go play. A redwood was just a tree to me as a kid. I had never seen it. But the question you asked, you know, how was it when you got back? Well, I finally seen the redwoods for what they were. You know, when I seen those old growth redwoods when I came back, I knew they were big. But I didn't realize they were just as majestic as they were. They were beautiful. And I was working for a tree service, climbing and doing line clearance tree trimming for PG&E. I love climbing. And when I first seen my first big old growth redwood after I came back from out of the service, I had to climb it. Everybody thought I was nuts. But as much as I love climbing, when I seen that huge redwood out there, and this was down in Sonoma County off of outside of Occidental. It was a tree. It was a memorial to Herbert Slater. There's Herbert Slater Junior High School in Santa Rosa, named after Senator Herbert Slater. They dedicated this tree to him. They call it Big Tree down there. It's on top of Joy Ridge. It's like 14 foot diameter, 250 foot tall, and it almost gets bigger as it goes up. Ah, it's a beautiful tree. It's the biggest one, I think, biggest redwood in Sonoma County. I got permission from the property owner to climb the tree. It took a little finagling, but I was able to. It took actually about 2 years to convince him to convince the property owner that I wouldn't hurt the tree by climbing it.
How did you finally convince? I mean, what was the deciding factor?
This fellow named Larry Moore owned the property that the tree was on. I asked him right up front if I could climb a tree after I got to know the people around there in that area, and he says, "No, I'm afraid you'd hurt it, Jer." You know, and I go, well, yeah, all right. And he was against cutting any trees at all. This was in 1972, winter of 72, 73. We had a snowstorm down there. Then it was the first big snow that had hit the coast since they logged the area there. Because it broke thousands of trees. It sounded like a huge battle going on. It knocked down power lines everywhere. It was just almost dead quiet. But then the trees started breaking. First limbs started snapping, and then tops were breaking out. Then whole trees were breaking over. They lived in the trees, they were leaving it. But they couldn't go nowhere because the roads were blocked with broken trees and down power lines. They were stuck where they were, you know, dodging it all through the night.
Surrounded like Custer.
Yeah, I worked for PG&E doing line clearance trimming, so we were working in the middle of this clearing the road so we can get in and get the power lines back up. Well, anyway, Larry Moore had a number of his trees around his place there, almost went through the house. He went total 180 degrees the other way. You know, he wanted to get everything that could reach his house down. And he called me. Well, Larry didn't have a telephone then. But his neighbor called me, who was a professor at Sonoma State College, Paul Molinari. Paul called me and he says, hey, Jerry, Larry Moore needs some trees cut and he wants to talk to you. I thought to myself, well, Larry doesn't want to cut a single tree. You know, he's a tree hugger, a lover, you know. And so, I thought, well, you know, this might be my chance to climb Big Tree. And it worked out just like that. I went right up to Larry and he showed me he says, if it can reach my house, Jerry, fall it. Get it down. He says, I'll take care of it after that. Just get it down. I did all the work according to our agreement. And he says, okay, what do I owe you? I told him, I says, Larry.
Funny you should ask.
Yeah, I says, if you let me climb that tree, the big tree was right next to his place. So I pointed to it. I says, it won't cost you a dime. He hem and hawed, you know. But he said, okay, Jer. He says, but don't hurt it. And I said, well, I can't. You can't hurt a tree like that. He says, the spikes, I want to see the spikes. I showed him my climbing spikes, spurs, climbers, whatever you want to call them. The points on them were about this long, 2 inches maybe. And he looked at me, he says, well, that won't even scratch the bark. And I says, well, yeah, you know, actually, I told him, I says, I'll wear them, but I probably won't use them because I'll be using ropes mostly. But where I need to get a foothold, a set of line and stuff, I might use them, you know. It was too early in the year to climb the tree. And I told him, let me postpone it until the climb until April or May when the weather improves and when the days get longer so I could climb that tree and get to the top of it and, you know, enjoy, you know, have a nice, beautiful day of it. Well, down on the ridge there at Larry's place, they had logged all of that in the 50s. And this was like 1973. So the trees around there at the time were only about 30, 40 feet tall, the second growth, and a few residual old growths that they left. And, of course, the Slater tree and a couple more that were memorial trees there. They stood out. You could see them for miles. The fishermen used them as landmark trees, you know, from the coast. When the day came to climb that tree, I got a line fixed in it and climbed the rope. And well, I made my way to the top. Now, got me up there about 250 feet over the ridge. And I could see the Bay Area, I could see the ocean, I could see Mount Tamalpais, I could see Tamales Bay, I could see it all. It was a beautiful, clear day. You know, I don't think there's been a day as clear since, you know.
Cool.
I just sat back up in the top of that tree and I had a lunch at my lunch and just enjoyed the view, stayed up there for a couple of hours.
Did you know about how high?
Yep. About 250 feet. Not for nights, as redwoods go, it's not a tall one, but it's big. And holds its size really well for a big tree. And I took some pictures while I was up in the tree. I mean, I had this epiphany up there. You know, I thought, wow, you know, I said, I bet nobody's ever been up in this tree before. You know, I said, I ought to write a story about it. You know, I ought to write a book about the redwoods. I was like 19 years old at the time. I didn't have much experience or anything about writing. I had nothing to draw from. I was like an empty well, you know. I needed time and working in the woods and getting to know the trees. And, you know, so I passed on that thought because I really didn't. I didn't know anything about writing or anything at the time. Of course, it comes about nearly 30 years later when I finally had some experience of working in the trees and climbing them and really getting to know them really well. Because I cleared cross-country power line right away for 18 years on the coast. And I had redwood, you know, under my fingernails, you know, because I mean, we groveled through the ground clearing these right-of-ways and, you know, climbing every tree on each side of the right-of-way for hundreds of miles, you know, and hiking through the woods. You know, I finally got all this experience, and I go, now I think, well, I ought to write a book about the redwoods. Well, by that time, I had thousands of photographs and all this experience. I go, well, heck, can't help but make a great book now. But actually, I did another book before that, and it was a technical reference for arborists. It's called The Fundamentals of General Tree Work. It was a 512-page book, how to climb a tree with a chainsaw and take it down in pieces. And let me tell you, when you get into technical descriptions and telling people how to do something like that, you better get it word perfect all the way through. That book was published in 1996, and it sold for over 20 years. All the way up to this year, it's finally out of print now because some of the chapters on climbing and entering the tree have changed so much in 20 years that the methods of entry and tools and stuff for climbing have changed dramatically since that book was published. Now, all the how-to about cutting and felling and the physics part of the tree work, that still all applies. That'll never change. But the methods of entry and climbing have changed dramatically especially since the internet came about and everybody's ideas are coming together and these fantastic tools for entering the trees. You know, you can set ropes from the ground 300 feet up in a tree now, you know, without even having to climb it first to set a rope in it.
Well, how do you do that? You
shoot
it up?
With big slingshots. Huge slingshots. It'll shoot, you know, fire line up there near 300 feet. And then you pull your ropes up into the tree with a string, and then you climb the rope. You really don't climb the tree. It's all rope climbing now. Anybody can climb through the top of a 300-foot-tall redwood, you know, with the tools and techniques they have now. But back in the old days when I started climbing in the 60s, it was all hook and spurs, old-school techniques. And when I went to work in the woods climbing and rigging trees, it was all old-school. But I had learned some rope technique as a line clearance trimmer. I combined all this knowledge that I knew about old-school and new-school techniques there and in methods of access and entering the tree. And this is what I started making my book about Fundamentals of General Tree Work. Like I said, it was 512 pages long. It was almost a 3-inch thick book. It was one of the best things I ever did because it sold really good. I actually made some money at it.
Damn.
Yeah, I really didn't think it would be received as good as it was. But nobody in the industry had come up with a book so extensive.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
You know, before that. I was the only one. Yeah, and still nobody has done it today. Some people have done other works, smaller, like 100-page books, paperbacks, that are maybe about methods of climbing. Nothing about cutting, because that's where you start getting into liabilities when you start telling people how to cut a tree in a loft, you know. And a lot of people don't want to take that risk of liability, you know, to tell people, you know, how to cut a tree down, how to climb and cut a tree down.
Well, speaking of, how many injuries did you procure over your career?
Oh, it wasn't without...
Because you got to learn that experience is based on learning the hard way.
Oh, I'm a lucky son of a gun. I broke my leg. Mostly they were ground accidents. I fell one time out of a tree in Montgomery Woods, about 40 feet, and knocked me unconscious. Came to the end of my rope and free fell for about 40 feet. Fell at the base of that big tree there, calling the back Montgomery Giant. We had climbed the tree to measure it, and on the way down there, I wasn't paying attention, and I come to the end of my rope, and phew, I don't even remember hitting. Because it had come as such a surprise, I didn't, by the time I didn't even realize it until I woke up. I was unconscious for a few minutes. Fred, one of the people that was with me, could hear it way in the background, you know, it was like a fart. Boy, Jer, are you all right? Can you hear me? You know, sounded like a real long ways, you know. And then the lights came on and then the pain. Oh, that hurt so bad. And I didn't even know where I was at. I knew I was hurt, but I didn't know where I was at and how, what happened, but it was all coming to me. And Richard Veeman was over me and he says, are you all right? And I says, well, I don't know. I says, I hurt so bad. I every part of me hurts, you know, even my hair hurts. So I started wiggling my toes and my fingers and my wrists and my arms and so far, no broken bones. And it was just impact injury, shock. From hitting the ground. The ground was like a mattress anyway there in Montgomery Woods. It's like, was like a foot deep of redwood needles. And
well, thank
I left
God
it.
For that. Huh?
Yeah, that's what, it's probably what kept me from being killed was landing. It was just like a mattress. And still pretty hard from 40 feet.
I'm sure it was.
That's the only accident I had aloft in the tree. Oh, I had minor cuts and stuff, you know, from handsaws and stuff like that. 42 years of working in the woods. The only cuts I ever had, you could put a Band-Aid on.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, no serious cuts at all. But that's not saying I didn't have some close calls, I'll tell you.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, the foot of the trees. It's like a foot thick. Let's talk about the ecosystem. I mean, the canopies of the redwoods. I mean, there's this whole other ecosystem that I'm guessing are supported by the redwoods. Just like other trees, other flora.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. There's really nothing up there other than some lichens and stuff that prefer that altitude off the ground because it's drier up there.
When I read in one of your books, you said that even though the redwoods are a riparian species, which are along waterways, they don't actually do well in actual wet areas.
Well, they love water,
right?
But they don't like their feet to get wet. You know, you'll see the willows. Yeah, they'll talk about the wood ecosystems, you know, where trees grow and stuff like that. You know, where alders and willows grow, it's too wet for a redwood to grow. Some redwoods might get established there, but they'll never do very well because it's just a little too wet for them. So the alders and the willows, you know, grow in those areas. Very specific. And yet the redwood is a water hog, but it's got to have a certain amount of aeration in the soil. It loves river flats because the soil is so porous and drains so well and yet retains water well too. So that's why they grow so big on the flats.
So the redwood habitat is basically a coastal temperate rainforest.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. See, I would never have thought of that as a rainforest.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
But it is, now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, and it gets more expansive the farther north you go. When you get up there in Oregon and Washington, the species of moss that lives in the forest there are tenfold up there, you know, because it starts getting drier and drier down here. You get down in Southern California around in the Santa Lucia Mountains, where the southern extent of the redwoods natural range ends in the Santa Lucia Mountains. They're just scattered patches into canyons down in the creek bottoms, you know, it's nothing like the redwood forest up here. Big redwood down there is like 7 or 8 foot in diameter, and they're rare. And most of them are maybe only 5 or 6 foot, you know, on average, the big ones. You know, you might find a 10-footer there, but they're rare. But you get up here, 10-foot redwood is average.
You see people selling the burls a lot, and I hadn't really thought about what the burls actually do, what their purpose was, until I read your book.
The main purpose of burl is to grow new roots for the tree. Redwood grows its roots from the outside. It keeps producing new roots from the base of the tree, what they call the root crown, where the roots go out into the soil. New roots form at the base of the tree where burl is and go out and supersede the roots that are behind them or under them. The root crown, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and the old roots underneath and in the middle of the tree, they die out. And when people go there to start cutting burl off the redwoods, well, it's like cutting off their feet, you know. That's their source of new roots to get bigger, to keep growing. I don't condone it. People who cut burl and, you know, for a living and stuff. Well, you know, in these logged over areas, burl cutters who dig up old stumps and stuff and mill slabs and stuff, that's one thing. But for somebody to just go out along a logging road or a creek bottom and cutting burl off trees just to sell it, that's not a good thing in my book, because you're hurting the trees. They focus on these trees because the long logging roads where the road cuts are, well, when they built those roads, the redwoods start growing a lot of burl to grow new roots because their roots were cut off when they built the road. And so here's the chance, you know, the only chance that they're going to be able to have to get new roots growing on those road cuts is by the burl that forms, because it grows off the tree like candle wax dripping off of a candle. And as soon as it touches the ground, it strikes root and takes off from there. But before they can do it, these burl cutters are going through there and whacking this stuff off. They do it repeatedly about every 10 or 15 years. You know, you got all this new burl coming over, you know, developing. And here's the chance for the redwood to get its roots reestablished, and someone comes through and whacks the burl off. And they're even doing it in the national and state parks up north, too. Prairie Creek has been hit hard by the burl cutters up there. Right there in the park, you know, they're cutting. These so-called burl cutters aren't even smart enough to know the difference between burl and other growths that aren't burl. The redwood has burl. Everybody calls anything that grows on the side of a redwood burl, but there's probably a half a dozen different growths on redwood that are not burl. But people who don't know, they'll cut it off and try to sell it or grow it. You know how they do it, put in a pan of water and grow their little redwood burl, you know.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, I've done it before. Years ago, before I knew better, I did the same thing. And I didn't think it was hurting the trees, none. But, of course, I didn't know that much about them at the time. And neither, you know, obviously the people that are doing it now, a lot of reasons they're doing it is economical. It's a way to make money, you know. And
like copper wiring.
Yeah. And I'm sure a lot of them don't feel they're hurting the tree any, you know, because it'll grow back. Sure, it'll grow back, you know. But if you stop, somebody else will come through and start cutting a burl on the trees too. And like the road cuts, the logging roads and the creek bottoms, or the draws and stuff, wherever water runs, where landslides are, where water courses are, those expose roots on the redwoods. And that's where you're going to find most of your burl on the redwoods and the road cuts. You know, it's where their roots are exposed that you're going to find burl. And that's where people go. I don't condone it, though.
Well, if somebody wanted to plant or start a redwood, what would you suggest?
Seed. You could go out just about any logging road, and if you walk out a ways, pretty soon you'll find redwoods growing between harvest plans. Maybe 10, 15, 20 years elapse between where they'll go into an area and do logging. And then they'll close the road up and won't be back for another 10, 15, 20 years, sometimes longer. If you go into an old log road that's been closed for 15 or 20 years, you're going to find all kinds of trees growing in there, just natural. Matter of fact, the natural-born trees outperform the planted ones, and that's a fact, too. If you walk out a closed road that's like that, it wouldn't hurt a darn thing if you went in there and dug up trees there to transplant, because when they come through to log that area again, they're going to open that road and dig all those trees out anyway. So, you know, if you want to find a redwood or to plant, just go out an old log road and find one growing in the road. dig it up. You'd be surprised. You know, if it's only an inch in diameter, maybe 2 or 3 foot tall, it'll have a, even as such a small tree like that, you'll have a, because of redwoods, they, the first thing they do is just grow a mass amount of roots and burl to get established. That's their first years in life is growing nothing but roots and burl. And after they get, then they'll start growing up once they get established, their roots established. Or seed. You can get redwood seed or just order seedlings from nurseries if you want to. Now, I've known people that's growing redwoods from burl. Just knock off a knot on a piece of burl and plant it, put it in the ground, and it'll grow a tree. Every part of the tree is, you can sprout roots and grow. They're pretty tough trees.
Well, let's look at some of the history of Northern California and the redwoods when the old timber barons kind of got around some of the legal.
The Timber and Stone Act came in effect in 1878, I think. 1862 was the Homestead Act, where you can buy, still homestead around here in California. The Timber and Stone Act was passed by Congress, and it was meant for the settlers here to have a chance to buy some land that had a going rate of $2.50 per acre. And they said, they called it non-farmable land. You could mine it, and you could log it, you know, because it was unfarmable, so it was like just $2.50 an acre. And it was intended only for civilians. It wasn't intended for the timber barons or the corporations back in the day. They took advantage of the law by giving money to people, buy the land, and then they would take it from them. So they procured all this timber land through here illegally. Congress at the time, they could have taken it back. But politically, it never would have happened. So the timber barons got the lion's share of all this timberland up here, what they could get at the time. And they were basically, you know, buying it for less than $2.50 an acre. Some of the homesteads up here that had bought the timberland, the corporations would offer them money up front for their timber. You know, back in the day, their dollar was worth quite a bit of money. That's how all these timberlands around here and up north got into corporate holdings.
And then you have the gold rush, which provided a need for the railroads, I guess, to be built.
Yeah, it was a booming time. Yeah.
The gold wasn't necessarily coming from the ground, but from the woods.
Red gold.
Yeah, red gold, exactly. Now explain why some of these stumps are cut so high.
There was a number of reasons. The lower part of an old growth tree is usually scarred from numerous fires. They hold a lot of defects from rot. They're swell butted. There's no straight grain in the stump. That's not saying all of them are, but most are, because the butt of the tree has held so much defects, and there was a lot of taper in it. And the mills didn't want a log that was 10 foot on one end and 3 foot on the other and only 20 foot long. You know, they wanted a nice straight tapered log, and you could only get a nice straight tapered log by going up 10, 15 feet up the stump, springboarding up and cutting it from there. Then you got a nice, uniform, round, straight, tapered log. Those were number ones. But what was below that, mills didn't want. Another reason they high stumped the trees was that their cross-cut saws were only so long. And they can only clear the trunk with the handles of the crosscuts maybe 10 feet up in the air past that taper. Again, probably for scars. Fire scars and stuff, they would have to board up to get above those. Especially like when you get into the codominant trees, the redwoods like to grow in multiple stems, and you get one redwood tree with 3 or 4 or more trunks on it. You have to board up above the crotch unions to be able to get your crosscut saws between the trunks to fall the trees. And you get some of these huge redwood stumps that they left there. They were progressively, as if there was 4 stumps in the clump, the last tree felled was usually the highest stump in the bunch. They kind of like staircased it. They'd fall one as low as they could, and then they'd have to get higher than it to fall the next one, and they'd have to get up a little bit higher to fall the next one behind it. And so these stumps got higher and higher as they were cutting the trees down in the clumps. Some of them were huge. There was a stump down on the South Fork of the Walla River that had to be 60 feet tall. It had maybe 5 or 6 trunks on it that averaged probably 6-7 foot in diameter. It was a sight to behold. It's still there. You used to be able to see that thing right out in the open on a river flat. I had my camera with me, and I didn't get a picture of it. Well, now they had logged there since, and all the reproduction in there is growing up there. You'll never get a picture of that stump again for another probably 60 or 70 years until it starts thinning out in there to where you can see it again. It's just all brush there now. Beautiful stumps. If there's any beauty in them, you know, I mean, they all tell a story.
When you're a kid, that is a place to play.
Yeah. So many of them are hollow, you know, little nooks and crannies.
Exactly.
And climbing up the springboard notches. And yeah, stumps were fun to explore.
Clear cutting was crazy, especially up Eureka area.
That was the norm. They didn't do select cut logging in the old growth. Select cut logging didn't come about until they started managing second growth. If they've tried, in latter years, beyond the 1900s, they had some experimental plots. Logging companies did some experimental select-cut logging in the old growth. But it didn't work. Every time you come in to log it again, let's say, well, you got to open the roads. Everything that grew up in the roads since the last time you logged there is going to get wiped out, mostly because you got to reopen the roads. So everything there that grew back, you know, is going to be killed. Everything in between the trees is going to get knocked down that came up between the trees and the roads. It's just too brutal. By the time you get done, you're back to square one again. In a second growth forest, the trees are a lot smaller, more manageable, and you have more room to put them in without breaking them in. You know, fit them in places without breaking them. Sounds like a good idea, but select cut logging old growth forest just doesn't work. But it does in second growth, because the trees are smaller.
So I thought it was interesting reading a little bit about Redwood League and Sierra Club working together for a few decades, but as usual, you get some new director coming in, and he altered the negotiations with the logging companies, and they kind of parted ways.
Yeah, Save the Redwoods, the original founders of Save the Redwoods, they were a different breed of people back then. I mean, it was just people were just different back then. They were all rich people, aristocrats. They all had money, and they all had a great idea. They didn't want to see this forest get wiped out. They solicited all their friends. You know, congressmen, big businessmen, barons, tycoons. I mean, even the lumber company executives and stuff. Guys were running the railroads through here, you know, where they were all upper crust, wealthy people. The founders of the league were bedfellows with them. And they're saying, hey, man, you know, why don't you save some of this stuff right here? We'd like to preserve all the stuff along the highway here. You got all this in behind these mountains, you know, from here, miles that way to log. Let us save this here along the corridor, you know, for a park. They paid what at the time was, what they figured was fair market value. Some of the timber barons thought otherwise, but it was almost like if he didn't donate something to the league, because it was a noble ambition, you know, to create this huge redwood park up here. And, you know, if you had all this money and all this timberland and stuff, you didn't do anything, then, you know, the rest of the people looked down on you. So they were almost compelled to. Big money. The story of Save the Redwoods is really great. Susan Schreffer published a book in 1978 called The Fight to Save the Redwoods. And it's not like what you think about timber protests and battles and stuff. There's part of that in there in the latter years with the Redwood National Park and its expansion. That's when timber protests started coming up around here. Big time in the 60s and 70s. Prior to that, though, it was all negotiating with the timber companies. And the Sierra Club, originally, they took care of the Sierras. That was their baby. And Save the Redwoods took care of the Redwoods. That was their baby. They pretty much kept that way until around the 50s and 60s, Sierra Club started feeling that the Save the Redwoods could do a little bit better job than they were. And they told them, they said, you know, your methods of negotiating with the timber companies is weak. You know, you should get tough on the timber companies and fight harder to get, you know, to get this timberland. And so Sierra Club felt compelled to take the lead in Save the Redwoods. And of course, that caused conflict between the two preservation groups. And I don't know if they've ever healed their wounds, but maybe they have. But it was a different breed of people back then. You know, the original founders, you know, they were a totally different breed of people than the people that are running it today. You know, because You know, today what you got is what's been saved is what we got. There's no more to save. We can buy more land, in which they are, and what are they buying? They're buying logged over second growth redwood forest land. There's nothing wrong with it. You look at Navarro redwoods, that's 150 years old, and there's trees in there 7-8 foot in diameter and 260 foot tall. And it was clear cut, logged, and burned down to stumps. And every second growth forest up here can do just what Navarro redwoods did. So go ahead, buy up as much second growth timberland you can because it's cheap and because there's so much of it. They were buying old per acre back in the league was paying something in the beginning, $30, $40 an acre for old growth. They're buying thousands of acres at a time. Now you're looking at $10,000 an acre. It was even steeper than that. The last big purchase was, of course, Headwaters Forest up in Humboldt County. That cost $380 million for 7,000 acres. It was only half old growth anyway. So it was only about 3,000 acres of old growth. And so do the math. Comes down to like, something like $50,000 an acre for old growth, you know, from $30 an acre. You know, in the 20s. It's just super inflated. Things have gotten totally out of hand in that respect.
So let's talk about some of the truth versus fiction regarding redwoods as it relates to activism and environmentalism. You were mentioning earlier about selective cutting is not what people assume it is. And then split products. What are some of the negative impacts on split products?
Well, it's a dead industry. The split products, that was an old growth industry, and there's no old growth harvesting anymore. There's the odd, there's still some private ranchers around here that have some old growth on them, and they do cut a tree now and then, an old growth redwood. And some of them use them for split products. But as a rule, it's a dead industry. It used to be huge, but it's not anymore. People are going out and cutting stumps and making split products out of that, but that's going to be over with soon enough anyway, because most of these big old stumps are half rotten, hollow, so there's not much in them that they can get.
And how would you explain what a split product actually is?
One of the finest split products, the epitome of split products in the day was paling. It was like lath or like this here.
Blinds.
Yeah, like blinds, you know. And a fine old growth tree could split like a deck of cards, 6-8 foot long. From 1/8 of an inch or 1/4 of an inch from one end all the way down to the other. But the lesser quality, where the more coarse grain, you'll never split paling out of anything like that, even if it is old growth. If it's got twist in it or curly wood in it, you're not going to be able to split paling out of it. But you can split rails, and you can also split shakes. The premium was paling. Paling that you could get out of one log would net you more money than you could get by splitting it into rails or shake bolts. You could get 50 cents a piece for a piece of paling, and there'll be thousands of pieces in a log, whereas there might only be 50 or 60 rails or 100 bolts in there, and you're only going to get, well, in the old days, you know, $2-3 for a rail. But a guy could split 100 a day, you know, even if he was only selling them for $4. It was lucrative. And when you're falling timber, when you look at the stump of a tree, you're looking at a lot of characteristics in that stump besides the direction that you're going to fall the tree, you know, where you're going to put your cuts. There's a lot of swirly, curly, and twisted grain down low on the stump of a tree. Doesn't bode well to cut, make a felling cut in a stump with all those kind of features, because what you need to be able to fall and guide a tree is straight vertical grain wood for your hinge wood. And the closer you try to cut a stump to the ground, the more twist, cross grain, and roots and stuff that you're going to have in the stump. And you're going to lose more trees that way. They will not. You may have it aimed to go one way, but it might not go that way because of the grain in the stump. With second growth trees, it's not too much of a problem trying to cut too low, but you couldn't do it in an old growth tree. You know, you needed to get up high to get above all that defect in the stump. And it still applies today. If you see a spot in the bark that doesn't look right, well, it's probably because of an old wound that healed over there, and it could be rotten underneath, or the grain in the wood isn't straight. You don't want to use that part of the stump for your hinge wood. You either cut above it or you angle around it.
Now, what are rip cuts?
Well, a cross cut, in order to, if a cross cut is easier to explain because that's what you do with a log when you're bucking it in a tree, when you're bucking it into logs. You get those nice square ends on the end of a log. Those are all called cross cuts. A rip cut follows the longitudinal axis of the tree. It follows the grain, as in sawing lumber. Those are rip cuts. It's a lot more difficult way of cutting trees. Cross cuts with a chainsaw, with a good sharp chain, just goes right
through.
Very
straightforward.
Yeah. You try to do a rip cut with a chainsaw, it doesn't work very good. It's, as a matter of fact, it's terrible.
Let's talk about how redwood forests are managed now. I mean, you talk about, you know, second growth. How do you manage a second growth forest? What all is involved with that?
When I started working in the woods here in 1975, there was still active old growth sides still going on here. But most of the logging was second growth that was going on. Probably 80% in the early 70s, 80% of the logging around here was second growth logging. And it was called, and what it was, is virgin second growth. It had, because it was second growth that hadn't been logged since the old growth trees were felled. They call it virgin second growth because it, you know, it's 100, 150 years old and beautiful. They look as just as good as an old growth forest does down in Southern California, because most of those trees down there don't get much bigger than that anyway, than a 150 year old tree here.
Who oversees the managed redwood forest, the second growth? Is there?
It's all done by involved. Whether it's a private ranch or corporate timberland. It's a legal requirement to have a certified registered professional forester to do your plan. And a forester will go out there and they'll, you can clear cut it if you want, but a forester will tell you what you could do with it. You know, in the long run, it could, that could be better. A forester can't tell you, well, at least 15, 20 years ago, they can't tell you that you can't do that. They'll draw up a logging plan. But most people are, they don't want to liquidate log their property. You know, they want to nibble at it, make a little money as they go along through the years. A RPF, Registered Professional Forester, for a good fee, will come on your property and mark the trees that should be select cut logged, places that maybe should be clear cut logged, especially when you get into patches of Douglas fir that are diseased. Why select cut a diseased forest? You're just going to perpetuate the disease. It's usually best to clear cut a diseased forest, like a burned forest or a beetle killed forest. Just get it down, replant, start new. That's the way nature does it anyway. But where you can, you know, the redwoods especially, select cut logging works really good. It's kind of like a checkerboard. Take every other one here and there. Better yet than a checkerboard is what they call a group selection. Because if you take out like every other tree, like a checkerboard, the trees that are left, the spacing is very uniform in there, and they'll fill up that space between themselves and canopy over, and nothing will grow underneath of them. So if you come through and select cut again, there's not going to be any reproduction from the trees that were left there. They'll shade them out. But a group selection takes broader areas, like maybe several hundred square feet here and there in the woods. They'll take three or four trees here instead of one. Take three or four here, four or five over here. Jump over there and take 10. Like that. And what it does is it opens areas in there where things will grow. They'll get the light to grow. When you come through the next time, you can log in those areas where you didn't take any trees out and leave those areas alone that you worked in 10, 15, 20 years before. You won't be impacting them as much. And so what you have is more like a quilt of patches of growing areas and patches of different stage age levels of the trees. The strict idea of select cut logging doesn't work as good as group selection. Group selection is, from my experience, and that's 50 years working in the woods, is the best way to select cut a forest.
Because
you have areas that are growing trees in between where you're logging them. It's not huge. It's not 40 acre clear cuts. It's like 3 acre clear cuts. 1 acre, 2 acres, here and there. And those areas won't be disturbed again. By the time you get back there again, which will be probably 30, 40 or more years in a group select, those areas are undisturbed. Whereas if you do the strict checkerboard pattern, you're working in every area in that forest. If you're taking one tree here and one here and one there and one there and one there, you're going through the whole forest, killing your reprod, doing your logging, your tractor logging or cable logging, falling the trees kills everything. But group selection minimizes that by having areas that are not disturbed 30, 40 years between, well, lapse before you go on those areas. Offers a lot more diversity of plant species and habitat for wildlife. Rather than coming in there every 10 or 15 years, you won't be coming into those areas for 30 or 40 or maybe more. I'm sure there's a lot better ways to explain it. It's rather than a checkboard, it's like a quilt.
And for those who haven't spent any time among the redwoods, and why haven't you, Avenue of the Giants. Wouldn't you say that would be the best introduction for someone who's never been to California, let alone spent time in the redwoods?
Oh, yeah. It's the largest redwood park in the state, 53,000 acres. It's beautiful. You know, a strong hiker could cover the trails in Humboldt Redwoods in a week. Good, strong hiker can cover all the trails in Humboldt Redwoods in a week. But there's 53,000 acres there. And, you know, a person that's lived here their whole life will never see it all. It's beautiful. The northern parks are like Humboldt Redwoods, Avenue of the Giants, Prairie Creek, and Jedediah Smith. They're the premium, they're the premier redwood parks in California. If anybody's going to come here to visit the redwoods, they got to go to those parks. I'm not dissing the South Coast redwoods, you know. I mean, they're beautiful too, but they can't match what's up here. They just can't. I traveled down there. I spent a couple of weeks hiking those trails down in Southern California, and I was hoping I'd find some really premier redwood groves down there, and couldn't. It was like second growth redwoods up here, more or less. But they were old growth trees, but they're only like 3 or 4 foot in diameter, you know. There's a lot more stressed out down there. A lot hotter, a lot drier, and a lot more fires. Now, almost every one of those groves down there show the effects of multiple fires raging through them. You know, a lot of the trees are just really, really scarred. Or you can go in some places like Rockefeller Flats there. You can go into those groves there. And there's trees in there that are over 700 years old that have absolutely no evidence of fire scar on them, side by side. You can see some of the older trees in there that do have fire scars on them. But there's trees all through there that haven't seen fire for hundreds of years. Especially like there's this one place up in Jedediah Smith, and the Boy Scout Trail off the Hallen Hill Road.
The Boy Scout Trail.
Yeah, yeah. And on that trail, it's actually called the Boy Scout Tree Trail.
Oh, okay.
But everybody, they contracted it. It's just called the Boy Scout Trail. That's what everybody calls it. There are huge redwoods on there. Just absolutely huge. They're hillside redwoods, too. They're on a slope. They're not down on the river flats or the creek bottoms. These are up on the mountain, and they're 15, 20 foot in diameter. They're beautiful, and there's not a fire scar on them. Those trees have not gone through a major fire in probably 500 or 600 years. It's amazing. It's an amazing part of the redwoods. It's where redwoods go when they die, I guess.
I think how would you describe the redwood to someone who's never seen one in person?
You know, this day and age with the internet and publications and media and stuff like that, everybody's seen the redwood. You know, they're really inspiring. You know, if you've never seen a redwood tree before and first time you see one, I mean a nice one, go up to the Avenue of the Giants and you get out of your car and look up at those trees that are 300 feet plus tall, you know, and they're 14, 15 foot in diameter all around you. You just can't help but be humbled by them and feel about that big. You can't get that feeling looking through a National Geographic magazine or watching a video about the redwoods. You got to be there in person, feel it, breathe the aerosols, you know, that smell of the redwood forest, you know. I went to Australia in 2012 to visit a friend, and there was a redwood grove there. It was planted, probably 100 years old. Trees were about as big around as this table. It was about maybe 10 acres of redwoods. They were all exactly the same size, planted on like 20-foot centers. They were all beautiful trees. But when I walked into that grove, the smell of the redwoods, just like being home again. There is nothing else like it.
Jerry says he's working on the 7th and final book in his series, focusing on Prairie Creek. So stay tuned. Do something different. Redwood seeds for a housewarming present.